Let's go tonight to the book of Exodus. We've had the oppression in Egypt, chapter 1, and we stopped this morning with the birth of the deliverer, chapter 2, and we have, first of all, his preparation in Egypt, and we talked about his preparation in his Hebrew home, and we noted, last of all, that there is an absence of names in chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. It just talks about a man and a woman and her, the daughter of Pharaoh. Then, of course, the reason for that is we are not to focus on people, but we're to focus on God. Also, in closing out that little section, notice the unusual circumstances of God's sovereign working. You get that down at verse 9. Pharaoh's daughter has told Miriam, his sister, to go find some woman to care for this child for me. So verse 9, Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him. And this is the mother. Well, let's read verse 8. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go ahead. So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then the Pharaoh's daughter said to her, that was to the mother, take him away, nurse him for me. And here is the ironical part. I shall give you wages. A mother is going to be paid to raise her children. And again, wouldn't some of you mothers love to be on a king's wages to raise your children? And so the ironical thing here is a mother is going to get paid wages to raise her own child. And, of course, the wages are going to come from the household of Pharaoh who had decreed the child's death. And as we said this morning, doesn't God have a marvelous sense of humor? He had to laugh over seeing that crazy Pharaoh trying to wipe out these people. And yet right out of his bank account is coming the money to pay a mother who is Jewish to raise her own child. That's the sovereignty of God in action. All right, now we're ready to look at his life in the Egyptian palace. Life in an Egyptian palace is described in chapter 2, verse 10, where we read, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. Several things here. Number one, we want to look at the remark made by Stephen about what happens in verse 10. You don't have a lot of information here in Genesis. The child grew, he was brought to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became a son. He's obviously in the palace. Now what happened to him while he was there? Go to Acts chapter 7, and we have a remark about what happened to him. Chapter 7, verses 21 and 22 of Acts. Verse 21 says, it says, after he had been exposed, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. And Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. And while we're here, notice a man of power in words and deeds. In other words, Moses was not only educated, but he was very fluent in the use of words, and he was very wise in the things that he did. Does that trigger anything else that you know about Moses? What's going to happen when God calls him to be his spokesman? He's going to come on with this line that, well, I'm not eloquent, never have been, am not now, and never will be. So what is that going to say? That is going to say when Moses said that, that was sheer unadulterated excuse. It wasn't true. Because according to this, he was an eloquent man. And so that throws light on the other passage that when God calls him, he is simply a big excuse maker and even contradicts what the real facts of the case are. All right, another remark is to another passage that relates to this, and that is Hebrews 11, 24 through 27. Now, to get the picture, we're going to have to be technical for just a minute. But once we get the picture, you'll see what's being said. Now, if you turn to chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews, beginning with verse 24. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Notice he did that when he had grown up. And we'll want to ask and answer the question, when was Moses grown up? And the answer to that will be when he was 40. When he grew up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward, at which time he was 40. Now, in the blank space between verse 26 and 27, pass 40 years. Because in verse 27, by faith he left Egypt. Now, in order to facilitate not having to go to all the passages involved, let me give you the facts and then you can substantiate them later. In first place, about putting the 40-year period between verses 26 and 27, according to Acts 7:23, and compare it with Exodus 2:11, Exodus 2:11 talks about the time when he was grown. And according to Acts 7:23, that was at age 40. So if you want to look at Exodus 2:11, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up, that is, he was 40 years of age. Then, in 11:27 of Hebrews, you've got the time that he left Egypt in the Passover. At that point, he was 80. We know that because Exodus 7:7 says that when he spoke to the Pharaoh, he was 80 years old. So the period, again, verses 26 and 26 before it is a 40-year break. It also shows that Moses had a lot of growing to do. The first time he left Egypt, why did he do it? Because he was scared to death of the wrath of the king. 40 years later, Hebrews notices that he left in the Passover and he was not afraid of the king. So, let's go to the little incident that's going to lead us into our next chapter beginning in 2:11. 2:11 through 15 is going to talk about how strongly he identified with Israel. Verse 11. It came about in those days when Moses had grown up, he's 40 now, that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that. When he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. So he has now killed an Egyptian. The next day, he goes out and he sees two Hebrews fighting with each other, and he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" And the offending man said, "Who made you a prince or a deliverer?" The word judge is used in the Old Testament for a deliverer. Who made you a prince or a deliverer over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." Now, in these verses, they say two things about Moses. They say something about where Moses was right, and they say something about where Moses was wrong. First of all, where Moses was right. Obviously, in this context, Moses is fed up with the oppression. He sees a Jew being beaten, and he does something about it to deliver the man. Now, that was right. As a matter of fact, God was thinking that, because go over to chapter 3. Moses was right in his desire to see the delivery, because he was thinking God's thoughts. Verse 7 says, "The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters. I'm aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians," and so forth. So God was looking down and says, "I'm tired of my people being misused, and I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to deliver them." Moses had the same thoughts, but there was a missing link. And the missing link was picked up by this Hebrew who said, "Who made you deliverer?" And so the thing then that was right about Moses, he was thinking God's thoughts about delivery. Moses was wrong in assuming leadership that was not his. Moses, we're going to find, is a very human being. And I'll tell you how he was human. He's human in the same way we are, in that when Moses was not asked to act, what did he do? He acted. Later on, he will be asked to act, and what will he do? He will argue and refuse. And I see smiles, which means your name could go in there. All right, Moses is very human along that line, and we'll see it over and over. All right, now we move from the preparation of Egypt now down to he has to flee. That's in verse 15. Pharaoh heard of the matter. He tried to kill Moses. Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian and sat down by the well. It was a particular well. And, of course, in the desert around the well would be many dwellers. So we now move to preparation in Midian. Preparation in Midian. And that finishes out chapter 2, verses 16 down through verse 25. Just a few comments about the narrative. He sits down by the wall. Two girls come up to feed their sheep or water their sheep. Some shepherds attack them. Moses protects them, draws water for them. They go home and report that this young man has been kind to them, and their father says, well, why don't you bring him home for dinner? They bring him in for dinner, and he stays for a period of time and marries one of the daughters named Zipporah. Then they have a son, and 40 years pass out there in the wilderness. The things we want to say about it are this. The flock of this man was unique. Verse 16, the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Now, the thing that is unique, and if you were reading a Hebrew Testament, you'd pick it up probably immediately, is that most men in agriculture had herds. They were made up of sheep. They were made up of goats. They were made up of cattle. They were made up of oxen. It was inevitably a mix. The unique thing about this man's flock is it was only sheep. Nothing there. The word flock will not allow any other animal into the picture except sheep. It is the word sheep. So they came to water their father's sheep. So the point is, the flock of Midian, the flock of the priest, was nothing but 100% sheep. And therefore, God is going to have Moses leading. Notice how chapter 3 begins. Moses was pastoring the sheep of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the west. Notice in your footnote, with the word west, it says rear part of the wilderness. That's because in Semitic thinking, whenever you give directions, you assume you're facing the east. Just like on a map points north. Semitic thinking was opposite. So that if you are looking east and someone would say, how do I get to such and such a place? You'd say, it's to the rear of the desert. And that means go west. And they come to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, let me ask and see if we can answer a question. God is going to have Moses spend 40 years doing nothing but shepherding sheep. Why was that preparation for leading Israel? Anyone have any idea why that is preparation? Inevitably, the character in the New Testament, what is the relationship? Shepherd, sheep. Both our relationship to the Lord and the pastor, shepherd, and the word meaning shepherd, and the sheep. And you have Peter being commissioned to feed the sheep. So the connection, inevitably, of leadership is that of shepherd and sheep. And the reason sheep are picked out, because sheep have all the characteristics of Christians. And when we went to Psalm 23, we did a few of those. But I think our answer here is going to be this, is Moses is going to learn how to shepherd God's flock by shepherding literal sheep. Another interesting thing in chapter 3, he is leading physical sheep to Horeb. In a very short time, he's going to be going over the same place to the same destination, and this time he is going to be shepherding a group of baying Israelites that will have all the characteristics of the sheep. They will stray, they will fall down, they will wander from the path, they will have to be picked up, they will have to be carried, they will go in mass like a group of sheep. As we read the account of a shepherd when we went to Psalm 23, noting that all it takes is one sheep to decide, I'm going astray, and the whole outfit will go. You come to Exodus 32, and what happens? One sheep says, we've gone out here in the wilderness to starve to death, and what happens? The whole congregation, including Aaron, goes astray. And so Moses needs to learn that, and he's learning it on the backside of the desert right here. Backside of the desert is a tough place to train, but nonetheless, this is where God puts him, and this is where he prepares for his leadership. He has a son, coming down to verse 22. And as is often the case, the entire longing and feeling of a person, a father, is expressed in his son's name, typical of the Old Testament. And so you come down to verse 22. She gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom. And Gershom means banishment. That's exactly what he felt. He was banished away from the people of Israel and says, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. By the way, and we will see this, Zipporah, his wife, never was sympathetic to Moses' cause. Very, very unfortunate type thing, though probably a training. We'll find many places where she did not identify with Moses at all, but simply went along with it in a duty. Zipporah was not a supportive wife as far as he was concerned. Obedient, but definitely not supportive. All right, with verse 23 through 25, we get the introduction to chapter 3, or the call of Moses. Verse 23, it came about in the course of many days that the king of Egypt died. The sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage. They cried out, their cry for help because the bondage rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. This begins to give us a little pattern in God's working, and you see it all in these verses. And the pattern is this. God promises, as he did to Abraham. Second, God waits, as he's doing right here in the book of Exodus, for many years. Finally, one day, God remembers, as he's doing right here in this book. And then when we get to chapter 12, God acts. And you stop to think how typical that is of God's working. We get along with every one of these except number 2. We like it that God promises. We like it when God remembers his promise when he does it instantaneously and acts instantaneously. Now, why do you suppose that God made a promise way back in Genesis and waited 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 and waited? And then after some 400 years of suffering, and we ought to put that, God waits while we suffer. He'll do that. Waits while we suffer. And Israel was oppressed for some 400 years. Then they cried out, and God remembered, and God acted in the Exodus to bring them out. And I think the answer to why God works that way is it is his purpose to teach us to be dependent upon his faithfulness and his timing. So let's put, it teaches dependency on two things. On God's faithfulness. Will you think because I wait, the promise is canceled? Teaches us dependence on God's faithfulness and God's timing. And you have all that pattern in verses 23. He recalls the Abrahamic covenant. Period of time passes by, then he remembers, and then he acts upon it. God is always faithful to his word, though there's often time of waiting to teach us dependency in the meantime. I would say, would you not, with this 40 years, does God put a premium on preparation or does he not? God is in no hurry, and if it takes 40 years on the backside of the desert, so be it. God puts a premium on timing. All right, now, number 3 in our outline, and chapter 3. We had the birth of the deliverer in chapter 2, and now chapter 3, we've got the call of the deliverer, and it takes up the entire third chapter. We will get as far tonight as about verse 7 or 8. And the first thing to note is the little section about the burning bush. The burning bush is 3, 1 through 6. How many burning, and the burning, that's dramatic. I mean, it's really dramatic. This bush that doesn't burn, God speaks out of the bush. How many burning bushes did Moses have in his lifetime? only one. And that points out that most of life is pretty mundane. God may give us some great experiences along the way, a few burning bushes, maybe only one, but that's rare. By and large, the working of God is not through the burning bush, but is in a more less dramatic way. So reading in verse 1, Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the sheep to the backside of the wilderness, came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And we might say, Moses, the next time you come to this mountain, you'll be leading God's flock. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him. Now we need to do some work with two things. Number one, the angel. 3:1-3. And then second, something about the words of the angel. And what we want to work with is, who is the angel of the Lord? And make several statements about him. Number one, when you trace the angel of the Lord throughout the Old Testament, the angel of the Lord always assumes the prerogatives of deity. The angel of the Lord always acts as God. Not as representative many times, though many times he does, but he acts as God. Let's look at that in chapter 16 of Genesis. Genesis 16. This angel of Jehovah is very important in the Old Testament. And I'll give you my conclusion before I come to it. The reason the angel of Jehovah is important is because he is Jesus Christ, pre-incarnate. Chapter 16, verse 7. It says, Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he, the angel of the Lord, said, Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I am fleeing the presence of my mistress Sarah. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, Return to your mistress and submit to her authority. Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, God said in the Abrahamic covenant that he would greatly multiply your descendants. And notice he is quoting from the Abrahamic covenant, but I misquoted it because notice what he does. When he quotes from the Abrahamic covenant, he does not say, He will greatly multiply you, but what? I will greatly multiply you. What kind of response would you get in the Old Testament if a person came along and quoted God's covenant and replaced his name with the I in God's covenants? Why does the angel do that? The angel is acting as though he were God, and the first evidence is he uses the first person pronoun in quoting the Lord, in quoting God. And you would think he would use the second and say he doesn't. So what is this saying? He's acting as God. Sticking with the same verses, down at verse 13. Well, verse 11 to continue. The angel of the Lord said to her further, quote, Behold, you're with child, and so forth. Here's what you're to name him. Then verse 13, she called the name of what? The Lord, Yahweh, who spoke to her, Thou art a God who sees, for she said, Have I remained alive after seeing him? That is God. The angel of Jehovah acts as God. Go over to Genesis 22 and verse 12. 22:12. Verse 11, to get the context, Abraham is about to slay his son Isaac, and in verse 11, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham, and he said, Here am I. And he said, Do not, this is the angel of the Lord now, Do not stretch out your hand against the lad, do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your only son from me. And the me antecedent is God, the antecedent of God is the angel of Jehovah. The angel of Jehovah acts as though he is deity. And I take it we might come to a conclusion. He acts as though he is deity because he is deity. Okay, Genesis 48. Genesis 48. Jacob is blessing his sons, and as he blessed Joseph, he said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who redeemed me." And notice the angel is directly parallel to God. The angel here is made synonymous to God. One more. Well, for our one more, let's go back to Exodus. Chapter 3 and verse 1. In chapter 3 and verse, he comes to the mountain of God, and in verse 2, it says, "The angel of the Lord appeared to him," and notice in verse 4, the angel of the Lord appears to him in the bush, and in verse 4, when the Lord saw that, notice, the Lord saw that he turned aside to look. God called to him in the midst of the bush. Notice in verse 2, the angel of the Lord is in the midst of the bush. And in verse 4, God is in the midst of the bush and says, "Moses, Moses," he said, "Here am I." And then he says, "Do not come here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place you're standing on is holy ground." He said, "Also I, the angel of Jehovah, am the God of your father, the God of Abraham," and so forth and so forth. So we find a place later in Judges where he accepts worship very openly and very gladly. So I think then, since the only way that God has ever revealed himself in a visible manner is how? Only through Jesus Christ. So this is a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Pre-incarnate Christ. And we see him throughout the entire Old Testament. Can you see how, for example, Abraham could say how the New Testament could say of Abraham, Abraham saw his day and rejoiced in it? Probably in the form of the angel of Jehovah. All right? Now, notice in the words next, the angel and now the words. What is he going to say? 3:4-6. Two things will be expressed here, and the first one will be God's personal relationship to Moses. Then, God's historical relationship to him. First of all, God's personal relationship, chapter 3, verses 3, 4, and 5. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him out of the midst of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses," and he said, "Here am I." Then he said, "Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground." So that is going to relate him to Moses personally. And the two things that Moses must grasp are these. Number one, God must be regarded as absolutely holy. God's holiness must be respected. God's holiness must be respected is the first part of the message to Moses that he's going to have to grasp. Now, looking at verse 5, what is the basic message of God's holiness? God is holy, therefore, come over and have a chat with God. No, the message of God's holiness is not that. That may be the message of God's love, but it is not the message of His holiness. The message of His holiness is, don't you dare approach me. Don't come any ways near me. That inevitably is the concept of God's holiness in the Old Testament. God's holiness says, you cannot approach me on your own terms. As a matter of fact, you can't approach me at all on your own. And notice that's exactly what he's telling Moses. Notice again, verse 5. Don't come near here. Why? The place on which you're standing is holy ground. God's holiness is a big keep out sign and says you cannot approach me. Now let's see that elsewhere. Exodus 19. God's holiness ought to remind us of a basic fact. And that basic fact is we cannot approach God on our own. The reason being, we're sinners. God's holiness is God's no trespassing sign. It's God's keep out sign. The cross will be God making it possible for us to have access. So chapter 19, they're getting ready to receive the law. And in verse 1, in the third month, the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt. On that very day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai, camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. And so Moses goes up into the mountain, and God is going to give them the law. And you come down to verse 9. God says, all right, tomorrow I'm going to make an appearance. So the Lord says to Moses, behold, I shall come to you in a thick cloud. What is God doing? He is hiding his presence. Why would he do that? Well, read on. In order that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe in you forever. And Moses goes, he tells the words to the people, and the people agree. And notice verse 11. He says, let them be ready for the third day, for on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. This is the holy God now. And you shall all come and have a chat. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. What is God saying? I'll communicate, but you can't come into my presence. And verse 13 continues the same thought. Then down to verse 20. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. The Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain. Moses went up. And the Lord spoke to Moses, go down, warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. And so forth. Let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. God's holiness says, you can't come into my presence without a mediator. And therefore, that's one of the first things that Moses must learn. Man cannot approach God because man is sinful and God is holy. It is God's keep-out sign. All right, back to Exodus 2 now. Moses' personal relationship, you've got to know that God is holy and you can't approach him without a go-between. Okay, second. First of all, God's holiness. God must be regarded with absolute reverence. You must revere God. You must recognize he is holy and therefore you cannot approach him. Second, he must be revered. Now that is expressed in verse 5 in the expression, don't come near, take your sandals off. The taking off of the sandals conveyed two things. Servants always served barefooted. So when you take off the sandal, you're taking the posture of servant. And so God is saying the posture you must have relative to me personally is must be a servant posture. They served without shoes. Second, and this is true in the many of your ancient religions, taking off the shoes indicated or symbolized the removal of pretense. As a matter of fact, the Sumerian priests carried that so far that they did all of their priestly acts naked because they said clothes are pretense. And let's face it, clothes hide lots of things. Nice shoes can hide ugly feet. And therefore, their thought was, in serving the Lord, there should be no pretense. And therefore, taking that off, and therefore he's saying, look, you must revere the Lord. You must have a servant posture, and you must worship him without any fake. There is to be no pretense at all. And that's symbolized by his taking off of his shoes or his sandals. All right, that's his personal relationship. Now, second is the historical relationship. And that's in the next verse. And the next verse is simply saying this, Moses, there is no new God, but there's going to be new revelation. And notice how he ties him into history in verse 6. He said also, I am the God of your father. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. In other words, God is assuring him that all of your past history, from Abraham and Isaac, I'm the same God, but now I'm ready to do something that is brand new. All right, now let's look, after we've got the burning bush, let's look at the call. 3:7-12. And in verse 7, you begin to have expressed what God's plan and purpose is. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, and I'm aware of their sufferings, so I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians. Now, I'd like to close out in the last 10 to 15 minutes in this section of dealing with what the purpose of God in the Exodus was first toward Israel. We're about to have it occur in a few chapters. What is the purpose of God in the Exodus toward Israel? Four things. Number one, the Exodus meant the beginning of new life. The Exodus meant the beginning of new life for Israel. For that, look at Exodus 12 and verse 2. Coming up to the Exodus, we want to know how it was significant to Israel and how it was significant to the Egyptians. First of all, what is the Exodus going to mean to, to Israel? Chapter 12. Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month, it's the month of the Exodus from Egypt, shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. So notice, basically, God is saying this. Moses, April is going to become January. This will be the first of year of your life as a nation. So life after the Exodus was marked off by a brand new calendar. And it started a new calendar because this will be the event around which the national life of Israel will begin. So we'll have a brand new life beginning. Second, it was the beginning of a new freedom. These are four elements that God says are involved in the Exodus, a brand new freedom. Exodus 12:3. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each to take a lamb for themselves, according to their father's households, a lamb for each household. And I'm in the wrong place. Well, I put down the wrong verse. Major point, wrong verse. It's where they're supposed to remember the bondage of Egypt. Can you skim through? Do you see it? It's here. Well, 27? No. 17? No. I must be in the completely wrong chapter. I'm sorry. At any rate, what he is going to say is that when you come out, you're to celebrate the Passover yearly, and you're to remember the bondage from which you were freed. And 13? There we go, 13:3. Well, it's not bad. It's only a chapter off. Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt from the house of slavery, for by a powerful hand of the Lord brought you out of this place, and so forth. So notice, it is a reminder of a brand new freedom on the part of Israel. The third thing it meant was a beginning of a brand new fellowship on their part. And that is found in Exodus 12:14, I hope. 12:14. A feast in the Old Testament inevitably was fellowship. And each year they would have the Feast of Passover. And so verse 14 says, "Now this day will be a memorial to you. You shall celebrate it as a feast to the Lord." In other words, this is the marking point of the new fellowship that you have with the Lord, and you're to celebrate it every year. Finally, it was a beginning of new assurance. And that is found in Exodus chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. Exodus 6, 7 and 8. He talks about the Exodus and says in verse 7, "Then I will take you for my people." He talks about his outstretched arm that's going to deliver them. "Then I will take you for my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know," or come to know, come to assurance, "that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the burdens of the Egyptians." Life, freedom, fellowship, assurance. It is not spiritualizing the text at all to say that this Passover things, the life that comes with it, the freedom and the fellowship and the assurance, is paralleled in what was provided by the death of Christ. Go to Luke chapter 9 and verse 28. Luke 9, 28. To see the significance of the Exodus is to see a great deal of the significance of the death of Christ. Simply because much of what the Exodus accomplished for Israel, the death of Christ accomplishes for us. Chapter 9 of Luke, verse 28. We're looking at the transfiguration. It says, "And some 8 days after these sayings, it came about that he took along Peter and James and John and went up to the mountain to pray. And while he was praying, the appearance of his face became different, and his clothing became white and gleaming. And behold, two men were talking with him, and they were Moses," get that, "Moses and Elijah, who, appearing in glory, were speaking of," and I'm going to give you the Greek exactly as it is, "speaking of the Exodus, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem." And so it's very interesting that Moses, who was present at the Exodus that gave new life and freedom and fellowship and assurance to the nation of Israel, when he appears to Jesus before his death, he calls it the Exodus. In fact, the words "his departure," "his" is a definite article in Greek, and the word "departure" is exodos. Only in the accusative case, exodon. And that was what was there. So, the death of Jesus is called the Exodus. Why? Because it accomplishes some of the same things that the Exodus there did. All right? What is the Exodus going to teach toward Egypt? Two things. It is going to be one of the major full-scale exposures of the falsity of idolatry. So it will expose idolatry on a large scale. Okay, let's see that in a few passages. Exodus 12, 12. So we said this morning, it's going to be the titanic struggle of the God of Israel versus the gods of Egypt. Exodus 12, 12. I just want to note in these passages the titanic struggle that is going to take place between the Lord and the gods of Egypt. God speaks in verse 12 and says, "I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord." Exodus is a titanic struggle in the first part of the book between the God of Israel and the gods of Egypt. Look at Exodus 8, 19. Very interesting. the magicians in the court of Pharaoh were convinced. They said, "We've lost. Israel has the true God." I don't know that any of them came to be believers, but they sure recognized that they had met the true God. Verse 19, "Then the magician said to Pharaoh, 'This is the finger of God.'" And so they admit there, but Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He did not listen. So notice they were convinced. Chapter 15 and verse 11. After they've come across the Red Sea, God has delivered them. The whole congregation sings this great hymn. Verse 11, "Who is like Thee among the gods, O Lord? Who is like Thee, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders?" And what are they saying? The God of Israel has won. He is the true God. Verse 14 of the same chapter. Notice the Exodus event was heard by other nations. It says, "The people have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. The chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling, grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of thine arm, they are motionless as stone." Notice the impact of the Exodus clear outside of Egypt up onto the other nations. Chapter 18 and verse 11. Jethro comes out of this thing, and he says, "I'm convinced by the Exodus that the God of Israel is the true God." Verse 11, he says, "Now I know that the Lord," or Yahweh, "is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people," referring to Egypt. All right, a second lesson directed toward Egypt is the futility of resisting God. The absolute futility of resisting God. And this is where it's going to get to be fun. Go back to chapter 5 and notice the first words of Exodus 5. First words of the Pharaoh. Absolute futility of resisting God when He is on the move. Chapter 15, verse 1, "Afterward," they're now making their request to let Israel go. "Afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel.'" Notice identifying who their God is. "The Lord," or Yahweh, "the God of Israel, 'let my people go that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness.' And Pharaoh said, 'Who is the Lord that I should obey His voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go.'" And boy, he didn't know what he was saying. Because the next chapters, from 5 on up to 12, will be a crescendo leading up to the hymn of chapter 15. And in chapter 15, if you can picture the dead bodies bobbing in the water, and Israel singing a hymn on the other side, and they come along and they sing to the Egyptians, and I quote part of it, it says, "The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is His name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea." And finally, look at Exodus 9 and verse 16. The Lord speaks to Pharaoh and says, "Pharaoh, your very existence has come about to display my power." Verse 16, "But indeed," this is the Lord speaking, "for this cause I have allowed you to remain, in order to show you my power and in order to proclaim my name throughout all of the earth." And God is simply saying, "I take all the gods of Egypt to prove that I am the true God." As we said, in coming into this part of Exodus, it is a titanic struggle between the God of Israel and the gods of Israel, the God of Egypt, proving that Yahweh is the only true God. Now, our Father, we're thankful tonight for Your Word. May we recognize, unlike Pharaoh, that it is futile to resist Your purpose. May we realize that to attempt to halt the purposes of God is to break our own selves. And we pray that we will see that futility in the coming weeks as we study the Exodus from Egypt, in Christ's name.